Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a congressional vote to sanction Russia that constrains President Trump in a clear rebuke, which indicates a distrust of the president's peculiar determination to please Putin. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, joins us to discuss her article at CNN, Trump's Authoritarian Playbook, What's Next?, and the authoritarian playbook that she witnessed in Italy under Berlusconi that Trump appears to be following, which could result in a constitutional crisis if he does what he is threatening to do by firing the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, and pardoning himself and his family. We'll examine the portent of a political and cultural civil war that Trump has laid the groundwork for, and the open appeal to American fascism in a recent NRA video that threatens armed insurrection against liberals with, quote, the clenched fist of truth. Then we will look into Trump's assertion that he has, quote, the complete power to pardon, and speak with Brian Colt, professor of law at Michigan State University and author of Constitutional Cliffhangers, a legal guide for presidents and their enemies, a book that identifies unresolved constitutional questions that could easily lead to chaos and crisis. We'll discuss what would happen if Trump fires Mueller, as he has threatened to do, and tries to pardon himself and his family. Then finally, we'll go to Warsaw, Poland, to speak with Jan Kubik, director of the School of Slavonic and East European Studies and provost for Europe at the University College London. He joins us to discuss the power grab by Poland's right-wing government in taking over the Constitutional Court and the encouragement that the anti-democratic right-wing governments in Poland and Hungary are getting from Sebastian Gorka, the Hungarian fascist in the White House, who is a close advisor to Donald Trump. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and politics of image, and has an article at CNN, Trump's Authoritarian Playbook, What's Next? Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
And it's pretty clear that Donald Trump has made it very clear, in fact, that he's threatening to fire Mueller if he crosses a line, which is looking into the family finances. And he also clearly, in his New York Times interview, is basically trying to sort of humiliate the Attorney General into quitting. And if he, of course, was able to get Jeff Sessions to quit, he could then put in his own Attorney General, who could then say, oh, look, I've looked into the Russian thing, there's nothing there, and close the whole investigation down. And he's also made it very clear that he wants to close the investigation down and that he's mad at Sessions because he didn't close the investigation down. Instead, he recused himself. So I find it just absolutely astounding that we have a president who is so clearly in your face, guilty, if you will, about something which we don't know what it is, but he doesn't want the American people to know what's in his tax returns, and he doesn't want this investigation into Russia to go any further. So what do you think's going on here?
I think that there's two dimensions to this. As I said in my article, the most important page of the authoritarian playbook is that the leader is in office not to serve the nation, but to protect his own position of power and often enrich himself along the way. So with Trump, you have definitely the desire to shut down investigation of his Russian ties, and which is linked to his, you know, non-release of tax returns. But there's the larger issue of, you know, protecting his power is not just the particular Russia situation, but his entire quite dubious and contested, universe of business practices. And this is what is in the tax returns, but it's a larger kind of discrediting of his entire legacy as a mogul and his children also, because they're so linked. All of that comes into play and is at stake for him in this investigation. So I think it's important to, there's the set and the subset, right? And so Russia could be as important and historically incredible as the Russia investigation is, it's a kind of Pandora's box for Trump of something larger.
Well, of course, this is a man who made a reputation on his TV reality show by shouting, "You're fired." And so far, he has fired Attorney General, Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, and used the firing of all the U.S. attorneys as a cover for firing Preet Bharara because he was about to close, or you know, a case was about to go into court that Preet Bharara had put together against these very Russian crooks that this lawyer who met with Donald Trump Jr. represented. And the U.S. government under Sessions, instead of getting the $230 million that was stolen from the Russian treasury, they ended up settling for $6 million. Something went on there. But this is a way to suggest that I don't think, given Trump's record, that he would blink for a minute in not fire Mueller if he felt he had to. What do you think would happen then?
Well, there's various scenarios, and the conservative commentator Jennifer Rubin had a very good op-ed in the Washington Post 2 days ago where she laid out five scenarios that, and she said they're all bad, right? If he fires Mueller and won't comply, though, to give the documents, right? Or we could go to constitutional crisis, and I'll let your next guest comment on that. But I'm worried about other things that could happen that Jennifer Rubin doesn't mention, where what will be the public, you know, there'll be public demonstrations. This could escalate into scenarios that would allow Trump's strongman side to take advantage of to perhaps, you know, do a crackdown. When an authoritarian is threatened and feels vulnerable is when they lash out, and sometimes people feel they've invented situations like Reichstag fires, right, from Hitler's Germany. But Putin had a kind of assassinations, which were very dubious, who ordered them at the beginning of his presidency. You have the coup of Erdogan in Turkey. You have these moments when something is bound to happen to the authoritarian, and these are the moments where things are very, very unpredictable. So the firing of Mueller, there's many ways it could play out, but there's also that as a background danger.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, and has an article at CNN, Trump's Authoritarian Playbook, What's Next? And we spoke earlier when you had you originally floated the idea of Trump's authoritarian playbook, and of course you have a unique perspective, being a specialist on Italy, of having witnessed the Berlusconi period, and there are fairly obvious parallels between Berlusconi and Donald Trump. And it's also worth noting that Berlusconi's best friend was Vladimir Putin, and it's pretty clear that Donald Trump has some peculiar relationship with Putin, where he just goes out of his way against the wishes of the American government to please Putin, and most recently getting rid of the CIA program to train and equip Syrian rebels. And it just goes on. And of course, I mentioned in the opening that the Congress appears to be, at least this Republican Congress, as craven as it is, appears to be aware of this and has passed a sanctions law against Russia that Trump can't, that overrides Trump's influence.
Yeah, that's a very, obviously, that's a very encouraging development. And it also, it's also intended to punish Russia for the annexation of Crimea. And that's also very important because, you know, this is part of a larger foreign policy agenda that has enormous significance and hooks up with anti-democratic, authoritarian things going on in Poland, as you'll discuss later in your show, and in Hungary, certainly. And it also hooks up with things that are this kind of conservative remoralization, defense of the white race. That's the rationale for part of the rationale for the GOP support of Trump, because this is their moment to have a leader who will let them push through these kinds of racist, in some case, programs such as voter suppression techniques that they've been waiting to do for a long time. And it's no accident that a lot of the politicians, such as Representative Steve King of Iowa, who are most exercised about the transformation of America into a minority-majority country, are looking to Russia, and Sebastian Gorka, who's in the administration, is one of them. They're looking to Russia as the kind of last great white hope of Europe. And this kind of protection of white Christendom is a big thing for the Polish leader, for Orban in Hungary. And this is a bigger frame that we need to keep in mind when we think of why there's so much support for Putin. So the fact that there was a rebuke issued in the middle of all this other stuff with Trump is also important in, as an assertion of democracy, of the rule of democracy.
Well, if Putin's not pulling the strings, which he appears to do, and I don't know the extent to which Trump is, in fact, you know, a version of the Manchurian candidate, the other person who has enormous influence over Trump and talks to him every day on the phone is Rupert Murdoch. And through Fox News and Breitbart and these other right-wing news organizations, they have managed to create an alternative universe in this country of Kellyanne Conway's Alternative Facts, where you have about 35% of the public simply not believing anything in the mainstream media, calling it fake news, as Trump does all the time, and believing that Trump is trustworthy and will fulfill his promises. And that it was verified by a recent ABC Washington Post poll that found 89% of Trump supporters believe that he will fulfill his promises and he's honest and trustworthy. Given that silo that's immune to facts and evidence that Trump has, that Murdoch and others have created that environment, my sense is that this is what he's using both as a crutch, but also as a cudgel, if you will. Because isn't there an implied threat here, in particularly in that NRA ad that I saw, that I couldn't believe? I've never seen the face of American fascism so naked as it was in this NRA ad, where they basically said, you know, we're going to come after the liberals, we're all armed, and we're going to, you know, use the clenched fist of truth. That's what worries me, is that, you know, he's already incited crowds at his rallies to attack the press, et cetera, call them the enemy of the people. All of that comes out of the authoritarian playbook. But when does it really, when do the wheels come off, or I guess the gloves come off?
Well, they're coming off as we speak. And what's so concerning right now with those NRA videos is, we know that the NRA has always held these opinions, but it's a question of timing. We have to ask, why do they feel that now is the right moment to go on an open assault of this manner and say such, you know, aggressive things? And so Newsweek had an article that came out yesterday or today about, you know, people starting to talk about what I alluded to before, that the cold civil war that Carl Bernstein talked about on CNN the other day, which has been created by these two universes, alternate realities that you were talking about in the media, when, you know, what is the chance that this could become a hot civil war? And these NRA videos are inciting exactly that. But to the point of how Trump uses the media and this kind of, I call it the culture of threat that he's been setting up since the campaign, there's also the point that the discrediting the media is a kind of insurance policy for authoritarians. And, you know, they cash it in if there's allegations of corruption or if there are events occur that merit a government crackdown, because this, no one will believe the, quote, mainstream media, and that's exactly what they need to happen. No one, because if you have an event that you use to trump up, so to speak, as justification for martial law, the media is the one who's going to investigate those events to see if they really were true or not, if they even happened. So there's a lot of things that are going on, none of them good, that you've pointed to that I think will come to a head, not a definitive head, but will come forward together and coalesce around this, what happens with this investigation.
Well, if, I mean, I as I said in the opening, Ruth Ben-Gvir, I think that Trump is, what he's trying to do is trying to force Sessions to resign. And I think the White House might well have been behind that leak to the Washington Post of NSA intercepts of the Russian ambassador Kislyak's communications to Moscow, where he apparently revealed that he spoke with Sessions about campaign matters. So that seems to be the playbook at the moment, where, you know, if he were able to fire Sessions and put in his own lackey as the AG, that person then would say, oh, we've looked into the Russian investigation, there's nothing there, and I'm going to close it down and fire Mueller. That would be, I think, an easier play for Trump than just the naked firing. And again, in terms of this constituency that Fox News and Breitbart have created, immune to fact and evidence, apparently the latest poll says, I think 1% of Trump supporters out in the red states have any interest in the Russian story at all. I mean, it's just not even on their radar. Whereas it's obviously becoming more and more an obsession on the part of liberals and Democrats, who, rather than come up with a good argument to get rid of Trump, are relying on this Russian story. So, what's your sense then of how that constitutional crisis might play out, given the craven nature of the Republicans, the sort of useless nature of the Democrats, the fact that half the population doesn't believe the press? In effect, all we've got left to stand up for justice in this country is the so-called deep state.
Yeah, it's very hard to predict or even have conjecture on how that would play out, because there are so many factors involved. I mean, one thing that Jennifer Rubin and others have floated is that Trump might resign preemptively, so as not to, you know, have his secrets revealed. And this goes back to the first point I was making, that resigning, and another law professor also talked about this in the press, resigning would protect his children, because this is, you know, what is his ultimate, what is most prized and precious to him? And that's his business empire, his money, his prestige. And if resigning, and Jennifer Rubin said then Pence would just carry on and Trump would make a good face of it and said, I've already accomplished all this wonderful things I've done, that would protect his assets, so to speak, without having to reveal anything. So what's of interest to me in all these different conjectures is which are the ones that are going to force him to reveal his secrets and which are not. And there's no way to predict, but I imagine that he would choose the one that would allow those secrets to go on being secret.
Well, just in closing then, do you think is there a way that you could have people power? I mean, we've seen evidence of it. The very day after the inauguration, there was this massive spontaneous gathering of women across this country and around the world. Far more people showed up than did at the inauguration, which, of course, poor Sean Spicer on his first day had to lie about the size of the crowd. So what is there any – I was just later in the program, we were talking about what's happening in Poland, where the young people are taking to the streets in droves, and mm-hmm. most of the population, at least 55%, according to a recent poll, are against this power grab by this right-wing government. So if you've got 35% of the population that are immune to facts and evidence and will blindly support Trump, you've still got 65% to work with.
Yeah, in places like Poland and Hungary, the floods of people in the streets have a different meaning because of it's a long time ago for young people. They weren't even born, some of them, but the fall of communism at the very, very end, you know, it was the floods of people in the street that kind of was a lever in getting rid of this communist officials and think about the Berlin Wall and all of that. In our country, I think that I've said this many times before, and including in my original authoritarian playbook article, it's very important to be visible and heard. It's very important for our own morale, because what happens is you can feel that events outstrip you, that you feel helpless, and you become, you hide away, and then the power has won. But in this case, I think that the protest has to be most effectively directed toward elected officials. And that's been happening with the town halls, with sitting outside people's offices over health care, and before that, the travel ban. And that is the way that you appeal to, you've called them craven, they need to get reelected. And that is the only, self-interest is what makes a lot of politicians act. So protest, yes, but it should be focused and directed as it has been already.
Well, Ruth Ben-Gad, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Ruth Ben-Gad, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been a recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, and has an article at CNN, Trump's Authoritarian Playbook, What's Next? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's assertion that he has, quote, the complete power to pardon.